not in anger, but out of love of God. He had several times during public worship cried aloud the Shem HaMefurash, a very special, awesome, hidden name of God. You know the name of God, as it comes down to us in our tradition, written with four consonants, Yud, He, Vav, He. There are no vowels. We don't know really how the ancients pronounced the word. And our fathers believed that only once a year, only one man, high priest, was allowed to pronounce the name as it was to be pronounced. He alone knew its secret. When on Yom Kippur, on the great white fast, he would enter the Holy of Holies, the innermost sanctuary of the temple, to offer there the confession of Israel. There and then alone would he speak awesome. It was probably pronounced something like Yahweh. We don't know. What we did know is, what we do know is that in public, during worship, during the reading of the Torah, we use surrogate names. Adonai, Adoshem. The mystics had the tradition that the illuminated among them, those who had mastered the secrets, knew that name. And their power to heal, to whisper over wounds, and to cure, in part derived from that knowledge, they would quietly whisper this name over the one they sought to cure. But no one spoke of heaven openly. For to do so was to be, according to pious tradition again, announcement that the Messianic age was the time of redemption of Israel, when God's name would be spoken openly, God's full power in heaven, it would fill you. Troubled by it, he's called Shabbatai Tzvi. Did not know why he had cried out, holy age. He had come to Gaza, visit there a young man who, for only 22 years, already gained a countrywide reputation as a man of insight, piety. His piety and learning and sensitivity allowed him to be a restorer of souls, take the shattered soul of a man, put it together, to have pain, use. His young doctor's name was Abraham Dayton, Ben Elisha Haim Ashkenazi. He's known in our tradition as Dayton, the prophet of God. He had somehow, by virtue of his asceticism, holy acts, his learning, and great mind, like most acute scholars of his day. By some kind of rare sensitivity, he used the word charisma in his power. He had the power to heal. Many places, older than me, and asleep. So did I come to him. The strange thing happened when the patient presented himself to God. The doctor threw himself on the ground, prostrated himself before Shabbatai Tzvi, and proclaimed him Messiah. Shabbatai Tzvi must have been taken aback. It was the last thing that he had expected. Oh yes, in those moments of exaltation, he had felt that divine power within him close to God, but to dream of being the Messiah, he that's nearly 40 years old, hardly known, in mission, living on the ascetic scheme. Must have bought everything. We're told that the two men met day in and day out, several weeks. Gaza, Then Nathan took Shabtai's day on a tour of the great holy places, particularly the rivers, the patriarchs, Hebron, Bethlehem. Somehow, after a month of brainwashing, reluctant Messiah allowed himself to be proclaimed publicly Messiah of Israel. Nathan went back to Gaza, proclaimed a great fast in Texas for all of the Jewish communities, announced that the Messiah had come, and Shabtai Tzvi drew to himself 12 disciples, one for each of the tribes of Israel, bought for himself a white horse, rode the horse up the hills to Jerusalem, and as legend required, rode the white horse 7 times around the city walls of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is inside. Now this whole bizarre episode could be dismissed as paranoia, neurosis, to Messiah. Except for the fact, within a matter of weeks, as fast as the bees can go from Gaza to the far corners of the Jewish diaspora, apparently the majority of the Jews, they live in Leghorn or in Amsterdam, Hamburg, Morocco or in Yemen, claim Shabtai Tzvi as the Messiah. Books that were published that year bore most of them on the 5th date, the first year of the redemption. Constantinople and Izmir and Salonika in Leghorn and Hamburg, there were reports. Literally tens of women and children and of men who had suddenly seen visions. And in their visions they had seen Shabtai Tzvi sitting on a great celestial throne being struck by God. Mission. Hard-headed businessmen, German, Holland, sold their businesses, left their family, go to Jerusalem to participate in the redemption. Time of exaltation and of near hysteria. We're told that during those first months there were very few in the cold, argued against, hated against, those who were playing as little reluctant and as the Messiah. Those of us who want to understand as well as to love our tradition may be tempted to think of Judaism as we describe it in our own day. We do well both to appreciate its grandeur, its breadth, and perhaps its purpose. Come to grips with this moment, this event, bizarre and strange though it be. This was one of the cataclysmic moments in history. It etched itself in the chronicles of the heart of the basis. Why had Nathan claimed Well, for much the same reason that Paul proclaimed Jesus. As far as we know, until that moment of meeting in the doctor's office, Nathan had never spoken a word to Shabtai Tzvi. But he had a vision. As a man of piety, as a spiritual, as a mystic, Nathan, like Shabtai, like so many others in those days, was wont to impose upon himself prayer vigils, fasting. Before Purim of that year, 1665, he had vowed to fast for 8 days and 8 nights. While he worshipped and studied during that period, he had many moments of fits, visions, and during one of these, he had clearly heard the voice of God. The impression had been clearly given to him. God will him proclaim Shabtai Tzvi as the Messiah. Now why should Nathan be concerned with Sire, I yield.
Israel desperately needed the sire. Because Israel believed that the sire was here to come. 1,500 years of meeting with the brave, the coming of the sire, may he arrive speedily. Their need had led them to believe that the text of Scripture revealed the timing of the coming of the Messiah. Long since, any number of those who calculated the end of the Messianic time had announced the year 1666 as the year in which the Messiah might be expected. More than this, these were desperate aging brothers. Great jury of the early medieval world had been the jury of Spain. 1492, that jury had been given 60 days. First, go into exile. And he had attempted conversion to come to Morados, and he had chosen exile. And for most of the next century, there were constant movements of these Jews as they tried to settle in, find a new home. Time and again, there was an Inquisition in Spain, converting those who had formally adopted Christianity but remained in their hearts. These were disrupted. The disruption spread from Spain to Europe. The 16 years before 1665, Cossacks erupted in the Crimea. Come out of Ukraine, they massacred most of the Jews of Eastern Europe. Several hundred thousand people had been killed. Perhaps 250,000 Jews had been sold as slaves. Slave markets. It's a bitter year. One story after another of persecution, oppression, pogrom, and of violence passed between them. No community was immune. There was a compensatory doctrine among the Jews. It held that the darker the day, the closer the dawn, the closer the coming of the sun. This doctrine goes by the name of Hebnei Mashiach, birth pains of the sun. The analogy, of course, is to childbirth. The closer the delivery, the sharper, more closely spaced the pain. The closer the coming of the Messiah, the sharper, the more closely spaced the persecution. So, paradoxically, this age looked upon the oppression which it endured as proof that the great dawn, redemption, was near. All the great mystics of this time were concerned with the Messiah. When will he come? When will be the time? Why this relatively unknown, innocuous man who had never had a single disciple before this moment? Many, many centuries before, Akiba had proclaimed General Bar Kokhba as the Messiah. When he had conquered Jerusalem and driven the Romans out, he had status, he had power, he had delivered Israel. It made sense. Why this little known setting? Man whose learning was certainly no greater than many in his day, whose piety was no profounder than any in his day, who had not been known as one of the principal minds of his day, why Shabbatai speak? Was Shabbatai? He was the son of a modest merchant who lived in Smyrna. He had been given the usual Talmudic education, had a good mind, done well. But he had from very early in his adolescence all the signs of a psychiatrist would call today manic depression. For long periods of time, he would withdraw. He would walk out into the fields. He would stay away. And then there would be sharp cycles of enthusiasm and exaltation. He would stay up the whole night singing his praise to God. Apparently, he had a magnificent dream. He's known as a warm man, a friendly man, so he was a harmless man. For the first 30 years of his life, whatever his erratic moments may have been, the people that needed his Smyrna break. Then when he turned 31, some scandal took place. May have been associated with a moment when Shabtai's knee during a service was so carried away, so manic, he raced over to the ark, took out one of the sacred Torahs, and spoke to it in a marriage vow. Ave Akhi Kadesh, be thou consecrated. He symbolically took the Torah scripture to himself and his wife. Whatever the reason, he was, in a sense, exiled from Smyrna and wandered around Thrace, Macedonia, Greece, Turkey. He ended up in Jerusalem. You know that Nathan of Gaza was studying. He may have seen this quiet figure walking in the street. He may have heard some of the holy, holy, subliminally, the idea of association with that affects me and this kind of ecstatic enthusiasm that they be that as it may, I can portray this man in silence. But understand how he could be a scholar, must for a moment enter the field of the world of Jewish mysticism, its theosophy, the esoteric, hidden Jewish mysticism. You must be willing to recognize that reason has not always ruled the roost, if we like to think about it. There is much that is reasonable, carefully reasonable, Kabbalah. It's intuitive, emotional. It deals with the dark and the unknown, transmigration of soul, possession, exaltation, and mystic translation. You must also recognize that for nearly 300 years, 16 to 18 centuries, emotional truth. This was a dominant theme. Jewish religion. Not always been the full devotee, a reasoning influence. Let me take you to the spot. The little town that spoke of south. It's in a hill town, just south of the Florida. Small town. Air, it's very high, the air is clear, one has a sense of being a little bit light. It's a mystery. Modern artists, modern visionary has drawn from there, and you know there are a number of artists who have sketched on this. But if you ask your guide about the history of the place, he'll show you any one of the literally hundreds of little synagogues. Some of them are no more than 15 by 20. Synagogues, which were the holy centers of some of the greatest and most pious leaders of our tradition in the 20th century. And like Isaac Luria, Chaim Vital, Moses Shapiro, there are major today, but in those days they were the great lights of the tradition. And they had been drawn to the spot. Not because it was a high place where there was good light to meet, because on a nearby hill near the village of Rome, there was a grave. A grave of a second century sage by the name of Simeon Bar Yochai, patron saint of all Jewish mysticism. man who is reputed to be the author of the Bible, the mystics, written so by Hippolyte, enlightened. Somehow the presence of the spirit and grave of this saint gave special power to it. Now, what was significant about the point of view of these learned men? Is this. However they defined their philosophic systems, they began with the assumption that something went terribly wrong with creation, at creation. Something had happened. It had been expected. When you look about yourself, violence, and there was persecution, and there was poverty, and there was endless misery. They spoke constantly of the separations which existed between God and his universe, between man and man, between Jew and his redemption, man and his anxious, shattered soul. Since they believed that creation was essentially a process of illumination, God, the great light, had allowed that light to go out and form the world as we know it, they assumed that what had gone wrong in creation was that part of the divine light had been trapped by man, caught in a shell, Lipak. It had gone out, been trapped, and could not now return to God. And they believed that only as all this light would be let loose, all this illumination could radiate again in the world, as divine light could then become one. Only then could redemption. What would allow the shells which held and imprisoned these sparks of the mind broken open? Here they cut out for themselves, charted for themselves a very special role. A role which, in the middle of oppression and dignity, gave to the Jew not only dignity, but a cosmic primacy. This is essentially what it is. Man is a composite creature of soul and flesh, of light and that which is eternal. If man, through study and through piety and through fasting and through prayer and vigil, can purify himself, and if he will only then perform the powerful rituals which God has commanded with intention, what they call kavana, with concern for what these rituals might do, his virtue, his will, reach out and transform the world by breaking open the shell, by freeing it yet above. When they worshiped, these mystics were not simply performing our rituals and ceremonies. Those are sociological terms. They were participating with God in the work of creation. Rather, they were restoring creation to its primal, its beautiful state. They were partners with God. The world could not be redeemed without their piety, without their learning, without their intention, without their religious act. Israel depended on these spirituals, and this, as did all of them. Little by little, reaching out, openingly, allowing the light. What use has a system such as this in the sun? Isn't it enough when Isaac Luria and Joseph Nero and Moses Cordero and all of these great sages and saints to pray until that final moment when the ultimate light of the church? We must remember that even as they gave dignity to man, to themselves, and to Jewish life, made it the central concern of life itself, they were also bound by the commission, Torah and Talmud spoke of this. So they had woven into this tradition a particular role for the Messiah. What was it? A said that there were some sparks of light which had been so deeply imprisoned in the material world, only a supernatural power could free them. It was beyond them, beyond their power of prayer and of intention. This was the work of the Messiah. Somehow, the panic person, light shut his feet and light fit their understanding of what the light was like. In his depression, he walked away from the routine, the synagogue, he would disappear for weeks into the wilderness. He had gone out into the material world to do the messianic work. And when he returned, filled with mania, filled with the panic enthusiasm, exalted, he was bringing back a triumph, another piece of work he had done. Each moment of depression is out doing the messianic work. Each moment of exaltation is proof of another victory. This is deeply, so deeply that when after some months of the disturbance which you can imagine which was created in Jerusalem by the activity of Shabbatai Tzvi came to the Turkish, the knowledge of the Turkish authorities ruled. When they clapped Shabbatai Tzvi in chains and brought him, imagine Messiah in chains, when they brought him in chains to Constantinople, when they finally brought him before the Divan, the High Court of the Sultan, when they sentenced Shabtai Tzvi to death, unless he was willing to convert to Islam, when preferring conversion to death, he converted. Tens of thousands of Jews prepared to say, this is but another evidence that the Messiah has gone out again into the material world, the world of error, the world of darkness, bringing a new truth. This is the final proof of how much he sacrifices himself. If you visited Turkey before the Second World War, still have visited a little sect of people called the Dönmen, D-O-N-M-E-N. These were all Muslims, sons of Muslims, the grandsons. These were all descendants of families that converted to Islam in 1666 to participate vicariously with Shabbat Tzvi, Messianic, who had been outwardly Muslim, gone to Mecca on pilgrimage, had observed the Muslim dietary laws, but who in matters of their internal discipline, matters having to do with marriage and divorce and parents, had remained Jewish, observed the Jewish and Muslim. 250 years, whatever daughter was married, son, married by a Qadi, then they would go to the marriage. The idea grew among them that their leader in this generation was Avatar, was a Shabbatai Tzvi reincarnate, the transmigration. So their leader in this generation had Shabbatai Tzvi's soul and was continuing this work until the moment of the ultimate. That's a strange story. Those of us who were raised canons of modern university science recognize psychiatry, pathology is involved in this. But I hope we also recognize the very important truths. First, I believe, is this. Man will be anything to preserve his faith. Man facing ugliness and cruelty of life. At a time when he is prisoner of an unchanging world where there is no hope, will yet construct his myths of the world, religious system, theology, which without the sense can't ourselves. If during those long centuries had counted. They were pushed and shoved and murdered and enslaved, exiled, beaten. They'd not been nothing more than the whipping boy of mankind who had been psychologically destroyed. Not survived. Having constructed this Kabbalah, said to them, your worship, your internal life is the most important thing that's happening in the world. Gave to their lives grace and future. There's more. When men live without faith, they construct the impossible. Have you noticed, as I have, how many new sects have been born, leader, there, these that have been produced by the people? Strange, seemingly simple, they have said something quite bizarre. But what do they share? 101 little circles of Buddhists and Hindu and Eastern devotees, Jesus groups, it's just seated in circles of truth. What do they share? Share a sense of what they're doing is important, and they share a gospel. It's a message of hope. Somehow, the great traditional faith and the modern secular philosophies, which we've been raised, do not communicate cohesive structure like so we've turned elsewhere, strange, bizarre, the dark other world, unreasonable world. Somehow when we apply reason to the news of the day or the economics of the day or the population explosion of the day, we don't like what we find. Man needs hope. Man needs a sense of being. Finally, I hope you recognize those very simplistic definitions which some tend to use in Judaism. Judaism is bad, doing good, Judaism, doing just in the public verse, great tragedy. Too narrow, too simple. A religion is something more than an ethic. Motive. Power of religion is that it encourages people to believe, be new, be changed. And it's worthwhile getting up and facing each day with some degree of enthusiasm and purpose. Life is not simply a burden that. And don't live simply in tragic times. At the end of all is a tale told by fools signifying nothing. Great motive power, the fuel of a religion, is that it somehow integrates what we see, a set of traditional values which we believe to be right, and tells us that with God's help, there still can be family. God, community, justice. It says, in short, that there must be something more than the Rand Corporation mentality. There's something more than our ability to look at cruel facts. survive the fragile plant which has been so. We are creatures dead apart. We can't survive a global flourishing. It's unwise to worship in the heart. Thus fate speaks to the soul. Gives us some sense. A series of horrors. Rather empty. I wouldn't want any of us to proclaim sharp types of being or using avatar as an aside. Not encouraging them to believe in using an aside. Nor am I encouraging you to go out and pick up some esoteric tome of Kabbalah and believe that you can find in it some deep, profound, immediate wisdom. You understand. I don't understand most of it. Certainly a bit different esoteric wisdom. I do suggest if this moment of our history is looked at seriously, it says something very important. Candles are important. Traditions have meaning. Calendar has a purpose. Warmth of religion. Prayer. It's its own own. Now before we break with this mystical moment, we have one or two announcements. Stephen Lampert, the chairman of this evening, will make them. And I'll ask you to remain for a moment to break with a